comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to the Kevin Smith Show, whoever you are, wherever you happen to be, all around this gorgeous planet we call Earth. Thank you for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. I know you could be doing a million other things, but you chose to be here. Thank you for that. I appreciate it. I'm here because you have a right to know, and because you matter. We've had some sad news over the weekend. I guess everyone by now knows that Neil Armstrong has passed away. Neil Armstrong, of course, was commander of the Apollo 11 flight, which meant that he was the first man to stand upon the surface of the moon. I realize that there are people who think that we did not go to the moon, and they've presented cases and evidence and that indicates that supports their views, and I'm not here to argue that. I've looked at it, and honestly, it doesn't, in my opinion, muster up. But I think we went to the moon, and I think Neil Armstrong was the first man to stand on the moon. But even if not, and I think he was a great gentleman. He served his country well. He was a military pilot, and It's just sad to have lost this man who made history, Neil Armstrong. We have a new feature in our members community. The new feature is that the latest show is this show after we finish. Every live show after we finish, we upload it. The video, we upload the audio as well, but we upload the video so that it's available for you to watch for the next 24 hours as our latest show. Well, it is now viewable on almost all mobile devices, iPhones, Androids, iPads, etc. And previously, some were able to watch it and some were not. Most were not. Now, if you have a mobile device and you are a member, then you can watch the latest show for 24 hours after we do the live show. Okay, it's up online for 24 hours until the next live show replaces it as the latest show. Another good reason for you to join our members community. And yet another good reason for you to join our members community is our monthly chat, where I go into the chat. You can go to the chat room anytime, arrange a chat with people and go into the chat room and, just chat away and have a good time in there. But once a month I go in and hang out for a couple of hours. This Saturday night will be our monthly chat for September. Be there at showtime. All right, we're going to step away just for a few minutes. We'll be back. All right. right. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. And my guest this evening is someone who's been with us before and someone I consider a friend and someone who always has something very compelling and interesting to talk about, Dr. Roger Lear. Dr. Lear, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. It's good to have you back with us.
And it's good to be back with you, Kevin.
You know, the last time you were here, you told us that you had been having problems with something wrong with one of your feet, and that you're really having a devil of a time getting the whatever it was to heal. And it went from bad at that point to worse. Why don't you catch us up on what has happened to you over the past few months here?
Well, okay. I started quite a few months back, actually the beginning of the year almost, with a case of shingles. And I got it on my left leg from my knee downward, and it settled in a blister like shingles does over the right side of my ankle, over the ankle bone. And I developed an ulcer, which over a period of time eroded away so you could see the internal anatomy was showing. So to make a long story short, I spent 13 days in the hospital and 7 hours in surgery to both increase the arterial circulation of my left leg and to undergo a skin graft from my right thigh to my left ankle. And I came home and went through 6 weeks worth of intravenous antibiotics put in through what's called a PICC line, which was a line that they instill from your arm and goes behind your heart into the large vein there, the vena cava. And then after that, I lost 40 pounds during the ordeal. And I started to gain my appetite back and finally started on a course of physical therapy and was doing pretty good. And then I came down with a case of pneumonia. So now kind of getting my voice back. So if I sound a little strange, why, that's because of the leftovers of the pneumonia. So anyway, I'm recovering and I got now most of my appetites back. I'm trying to gain a little weight, do a little exercise, and pretty soon I'll be starting back on the physical therapy again.
So have you been able at all to carry on your practice?
Well, I was off for about 4 months. I had somebody coming in part-time, which I had to pay. I had no income, lost about everything that I had, every nickel. Mm-hmm. And there's been some kindness shown, particularly in the UFO community, towards me. MUFON put on two big benefit events that were sponsored by Whitley Strieber. Currently, Philip Mantle from the UK is holding an auction of some rare items, and that is supposed to be for my benefit. So I've had a number of people come forth. I've had to sell my car and a couple of other things I had so that we could pay the bills and eat.
Yeah.
I'm still alive and kicking, and of course during my recuperative phase, right before this happened, I signed a contract with a French publishing company for a new book, which is something I swore I'd never do, but I did, and when I was recuperating, I was able to finish the book, and the galleys are out now, and it should be on the market in France in a couple of weeks.
And what's it called?
It's called, the English title of it is UFOs, Alien Abductions, Implants, The Final Frontier.
And is it going to be available in English soon?
Yeah, once it comes out in France, I've already gotten offers from an English publishing company here in the U.S. that will publish it, so we'll get it out. We have to reformat the book because it's published in a style for a French audience.
If I'm not mistaken, Whitley Strieber set up a way for people to donate to assist you in during this recovery period, didn't he? Is that still
yes,
up on his site?
He set up through the help of my family a trust fund, mm-hmm. and it's available on the website alienscalpel.com. There's actually two of them there. One, somebody wants to donate to the research, which is still going on. We have a few new findings we just got about 4 days ago. And another one that would go into a trust account for me personally. So, he made a very generous donation to kick the thing off. So Whitley has been a very, very dear friend.
Well, I would like to urge everyone in our audience to go to alienscalpel.com and click that button to make a donation. And that's not really why I brought you on the show here tonight, but I think people need to know about it. You know, honestly, that information did not filter to me until just before I called you. And
really?
I heard a little bit about it, but no real details. And,
oh, my goodness.
I knew that.
Strange. As long as we're on the subject and we've got the audience out there, I want to tell you something. Shingles today is an epidemic. And it used to be a long time ago when I went to school, shingles was known to be caused by a virus called herpes zoster. And I remember looking at it through the electron microscope, and it had its own particular DNA structure. And you got it around the intercostal areas, around the ribs, and it was extremely painful. The skin was so painful you couldn't stand the shirt touching it or anything else, and then you got little blisters. That was shingles way back. Now, shingles today is a different breed, and they're telling people that it's related to chicken pox. Well, unless chicken pox has changed, this has absolutely no relationship to the chicken pox virus whatsoever. And then I find very strangely that the epidemic of shingles came about not long after the pharmaceutical companies decided that there was a danger from getting shingles and started vaccinating everybody. So maybe I'm over suspicious. I can't ground these findings with scientific fact, but when you put two and two together, it looks very suspicious to me that maybe something got out in the environment that was artificial, and they had to develop a quick vaccine for it. But every patient I know, and this is almost 100%, that's got a shingles vaccination has within 6 months come down with shingles. And it's a terrible form today because you can get it anywhere, on your arm, on your leg, on your face, in your eye, in your mouth. So they say the people who get it in the eye, they scream in pain because they'd rather have their eye removed.
Wow. Wow.
So there we are today, August the 27th of 2012.
Well, I'll tell you, I know you've been through a terrible ordeal, and I'm glad to know that you are recovering. And, folks, if you have a extra buck or two or 10 or 20 or 200 or 500, get over to alienscapel.com and make a donation. Look, you've heard the story. You know what happened.
You know, it certainly won't go unappreciated because I have very little to sustain myself until I'm able to get back to work. And I just basically have to build up. I've been in practice for 47 years, and I have to start it almost from scratch again. So it's going to take a while.
Yeah, it is. It is. Well, that part of the news is tough news, sad news, but the other side of the news, you're recovering, and that's good news.
Yeah. Real, real good.
Yeah. Nice, you mentioned just a moment ago.
Do something and not have any pain or be... I'm not saying my ankle is not sore.
Mm-hmm.
I go once a week to the graft surgeon, and he does a little bit of work on it. So it's healing slowly. They're making bets now, so kind of exciting. I'm saying Christmas, and some of them are saying Thanksgiving. So we'll see.
Yeah, yeah. All right. You said just a few minutes ago that you have some new findings from about 4 months ago.
4 days ago.
4 days ago. I misunderstood.
4 days ago. Right.
Are you able to share those with us?
Absolutely. I can even tell you who the individual is because he's been on the air on a number of different radio and TV programs. He was a patient that we did a number of years ago, removing an object from his wrist by the name of Tim Cullen. And Tim lives in a very small town in Yuma, Colorado. And he's become quite an advocate politically for bugging congressional people about what happened to him and trying to get them involved in releasing UFO information. So I don't mind mentioning his name. Now, as time goes on, we mentioned the last time I was on the air that you begin to have new equipment and to available, and when you do that, you can look for different things. So we're looking at some of the older specimens again, you know, for carbon nanotechnology and other things. But we found in Tim's specimen something that's never been discovered before. It's largely an iron composite, which many of these are, containing boron and copper. So we decided to run what are called isotopic ratios on the copper and the boron in the sample. And we just got the results back. Now, the boron was straight on, and anyone can go on the internet and you can look up an isotopic table of abundances or the natural isotopes for any element that is on the Earth. So when we look at the boron, we see it's right on. It's earthly boron. But however, when we look at the copper, it's over 3% off. That means it's not copper that was mined on Earth.
Okay.
And that's pretty exciting.
Yeah. Any idea where it would be mined?
Well, not yet. It's a little too soon. But we've had Dr. Bob Kuntz. I don't know if you've had him on the show.
No, we have not.
Yeah, Bob's one of the leading nuclear physicists in the world. And... unfortunately, about 6 months ago, he had a stroke, and he recovered, and he's just starting to get his speech back. But we've been conversing on the email. So Bob has done some mathematical calculations, which are far beyond my capacity for understanding, but on some of the elements and the isotopes that we have isolated in the past. And he said that as far as distance is concerned, they come from about one-third away across the Milky Way galaxy.
About a third of the way across the Milky Way.
Right. Now, we're talking about 30 million light years, I believe. So this would be one-third the way across.
For those who are just joining us.
Also, he was talking about the age, and by using a constant, which is derived from what we believe was the beginning or the Big Bang or whatever is accepted today, that he's able to calculate the age of the civilization that's using it, and they are millions of years older than we are. Now, our good friend Uncle Stan Friedman says that if you live in New York, you wouldn't go to New Jersey to buy a loaf of bread. So if we can say that the materials or the elements that come from a specific area of the universe are being used in these objects, then obviously the civilization that's using them or mining them is probably relatively nearby. So that is a tremendous advance in finding, and it'll be in my new book. And it's strange, Kevin.
Yes, it is. Now, for those who have just joined us, we're talking with Dr. Roger Lear, famous the world over as the guy who takes alien implants out of people's bodies. And his website is alienscapel.com. And on that website, you'll see information about his work. And I think you've got some photographs there of some of it. Am I right, Dr. Lear?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And
not just implants either. We try and look at things from a scientific perspective. And anything that might be in the news that's newsworthy, we'll put it up there and let the experts and take a look at it.
All right. We have to step away for a break here in just a few seconds. And when we come back, we're going to continue talking with Dr. Roger Lear. This whole thing about people finding implants in their bodies in various places. It was big, big news at one time, and people were really all abuzz about it. But like everything else, people lose interest after a little while. Well, you shouldn't, because whoever's putting those implants in has it.
The Kevin Smith Show. When it comes to the world of the strange and unexplained, Kevin ropes in the information like a radio cowboy and rustles it to the ground with no mercy. He's our voice because we matter. Become a member today.
Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and my guest this evening, Dr. Roger Lear, world-renowned for his work with removing alien implants from people's bodies. And Dr. Lear, one of the implants that you've told us about previously, an implant that just absolutely intrigues me, is the one that was transmitting. And is this the one that you were able to Bob Kuntz was able to determine was from a third of the way across the galaxy?
Well, actually, about five now that are all transmitting in the VHF range. And we've gotten, again, this is recent, but on one of the shows I was on, somebody heard about it, and they got in touch with me, and the guy is a retired military communications officer, and he, hang on just a sec. I had to stop to wet my whistle.
All right, that's fair.
Anyway,
he
got real interested in the frequencies that we were talking about, and he was not only retired military but retired police communications officer, very, very much interested in the subject and what we were finding. His expertise, he said, left off at the upper spectrum of the VHS spectrum. But he has a little bit of knowledge of scalar technology. But he verified that one of the other frequencies that we were talking about happens to be a deep space frequency. Deep space communication frequency. So... what he did was he sent me a 21-page table. It's written in about a pica 9, 21 pages of every single frequency of every satellite in orbit.
And did you find this particular frequency on that list?
Yeah, he pointed out this frequency was on the list, and it was a deep space satellite. We haven't had time to go through the 21 pages yet and look and see, what other frequencies that we found. So that's interesting that you brought that up.
Okay, so a deep space satellite, and who owns that satellite?
Well, these are world-owned. The 21 pages list every single country that has these satellites in orbit.
Yeah, but the one where that frequency is communicating with a deep space satellite, that particular satellite, who owns that?
That particular satellite that we got before we got this new information was American.
Is it military?
I don't know. I'd have to go to take the information that we already have. All it says in the chart that I originally got was a fixed or mobile deep space communication frequency.
Okay.
So we have to go back now because the information that I just received tells not only where the satellite is, but who owns it and et cetera and what it's doing.
Okay. So... This particular implant that's communicating with that on that particular frequency, is it one of the ones that has been determined by its isotopic ratios to have come from a third of the way across the galaxy?
That's correct. Now, the question is this, and I posed it to this new guy, is that why in the world would an advanced civilization be using a radio wave at all? And the answer, with all logic, is that they wouldn't. SETI, set up this whole program to cover the sky and look for radio waves. If they found a radio wave of some kind of an intelligent source, that source would probably be coming from a civilization about our own age. It wouldn't be coming from an advanced civilization. Now, our scientific people with ANS research think that the method of communication that they're using are scalar waves. Now, scalar waves are faster than the speed of light. But, there's only two, really two logical possibilities. So if you're getting something coming out of one of these things and it's a deep space satellite communication frequency, it means that somebody is piggybacking on this information, and that somebody is earthly. So it shows that maybe some folks are working together.
Well, and I'm glad you said that, because that's exactly where I was headed with this line of questioning. So if the material for the implant is coming from, is manufactured, it's coming from a third of the way across the galaxy, but the frequency is one that we use, then it does sort of indicate that there's some partnership there, doesn't it?
It sure does. Because, like I said, you know, thinking that an advanced civilization that's millions of years older than we are is going to operate with radio waves is totally ludicrous. Mm-hmm. Stan Friedman calls the SETI a silly effort to investigate.
And, yeah.
I always get a chuckle out of that.
Well, and I agree with it, because any advanced civilization, if they are advanced enough to get from there to here, then radio waves are moving way too slow for them to use for communication. They would be outrunning them.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, even the best of science fiction, Gene Roddenberry, in the Star Trek series, you know, talked about subspace communication, hyperspace communication. Even they didn't, you know, in a science fiction program, supposedly, they didn't even use radio waves.
Yeah. Okay, now a third of the way across the galaxy, in which direction? Do we know that?
No. That I don't know. But, you know, in relation to where we are, if you don't know where we are, then it doesn't do much good to try and tell you where downtown is.
Yeah.
We're just on a little arm that's kind of split off from the main section of the galaxy itself. So we're out in kind of in the country, in the boonies.
Mm-hmm.
So when we say, you know, one-third across, now you can look at the Milky Way galaxy, you can look at it on the Internet, turned on its side, and it looks like a disk. And so, you know, if you picture that in your mind, and we're out on one little arm, and we look at a 78 RPM record, let's say, you know, we're looking, you know, towards the middle of the galaxy, or towards the middle of the disk.
And how many light years away is that?
I figured about 30 million light years.
30 million light years. So what we would be talking about here, here is a manufactured, and I assume, based on what you told us previously, that you're able to determine that these are manufactured. These are not just some kind of natural something that fell from the sky. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. These are constructs that are highly advanced, let's say, communication devices on a molecular level. I once read a book called In League with the UFO. Very small little book, very interesting. Supposed to have been total fiction, of course, but when you read it, there was a certain reality that jumped out and slapped you in the face. But one of the things secret branch of the military, our military, had found a flying disc and isolated it, but they couldn't even find out how to get into it. So they cajoled several scientists under duress to leave their families and friends and be isolated in this base in the desert and try and find out, you know, what this thing was. Well, I'm not going to go into the whole story, but they finally did get into it, and they found a compartment. And the compartment contained instruments of some kind, but they didn't know what the instruments did. When they finally found out what some of them did, they noticed that they only retained their shape for a certain period of time, but the function remained the same. So when we look at these small metallic objects, you know, which look like little, majority of them look like little rods, little metallic rods, they contain material in them, which is most probably changeable, because we've had two now that have kind of reassembled themselves in the bottom of the specimen container. When you shake them up in pieces and you throw them back in there, they kind of line up the way that they did before. So, you know, it's more than memory metal. You know, as we find the hardness of nanotechnology involved, and nanotubes one on top of the other, making a nano fiber, and then wrapping these together into a nano strand, is analogous on a subatomic level of what we do with wiring, don't we? We have a single wire, and then
sure.
We take that wire, wrap it with other wires, and we make a cable. And now, of course, we're in our supposedly advanced technology. We're not using wires anymore. We're using fiber optics, but we're still wrapping them in cables. So it's the same technology, except a cable you can hold in your hand, but a nanotube you can't.
Well, okay, so if these are coming from a third of the way across the galaxy and they're manufactured, that means they got from 30 million light years away to here. They, I would suspect, did not fly here by themselves. I would suspect they were brought here by whoever manufactured them. That means whoever manufactured them, 30 million light years away, has the ability to travel 30 million light years in a rather reasonable amount of time, and certainly not at 30 million years. So these people would be highly advanced, way advanced ahead of us. But it suggests...
His conclusion is that there are millions of years ahead of us.
Okay, we have to take a break. It also suggests something else, and I want to throw that out when we come back from this break and see what you think about it, Dr. Lear. It suggests at least one other thing, and I think it's one other thing that is highly important, but I don't see how it could be avoided. So we'll be back right after this. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, where we're talking this evening with Dr. Roger Lear. And Dr. Lear, when we went away for break, I said this whole thing about it's manufactured and your nuclear physicist has been able to determine that it comes from some 30 million light years away from the Earth. Well, that suggests one thing, and that's pretty obvious, and that's whoever manufactured it 30 million light years away from the Earth has the ability to travel 30 million light years in a reasonable amount of time. It also suggests something else. It suggests that perhaps we humans are also able to travel some 30 million light years in a reasonable amount of time, maybe not as fast as they, in order for us to have any kind of diplomatic relations with them.
Well, that's an interesting point. we have to take one other factor into consideration, is that 30 million light years in our concept of time, we don't know how long they've been here. You know, maybe they've been here for a couple of million years already.
So maybe it's they're in our neighborhood kind of as an outpost.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there may be artifacts all over the solar system. And then we have this skullduggery going on called the black budget. And you hear a lot of stories of people who have worked on black budget projects. Some of them sure sound legitimate to me. And we have the capability of, using our tractor and plowing around the solar system like advanced technology, they say, is 100 years more advanced than our own academic technology. So it gets very confusing.
Okay, let's assume that they are hanging out in our neighborhood. Maybe they've been here a couple of million years. Where would you suspect in our neighborhood they're hanging out?
Well, we're discovering artifacts on the moon. Jose Escamilla has just finished this film called Celestial, in which he uses 152 photographs filmed by NASA.
Yeah.
In color.
Yeah.
Of the moon.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see all kinds of things. It's not like a Rorschach where you have to make something up and say, oh, that looks like this, but you can actually see what it is. Then he discovered an amateur astronomer who built a telescope when connected it to a camera, and he also was able to take colored photographs of the moon. Well, the moon is not black and white.
No, it's not.
It's, you know, it's color. I mean, I happen to be at JPL when a live feed was coming in from Mars. I don't remember whether it was one of the rovers or before the rovers. And they had several screens lit up, and they wouldn't let anybody in the room, but you could look through an open window and you could look at the screens. And here this first picture comes in, and they put it through its telemetric gymnastics, and it's been digitized, they roll it into a picture which comes out in streaks. And you look at it, and you look at the sky, and the sky is blue. And I turned around the person next to me, and I said, what the hell is that? You know, Mars with a blue sky? And then the next screen, suddenly the sky was pink.
Yeah.
And they said, I said, what in the world is going on here? Well, they added filters.
Mm-hmm.
And they made the sky pink to reflect the redness of the soil.
Well, and the soil on Mars is simply not as red as what they make it. It looks like the soil in the desert southwest of the United States.
Yeah.
And in fact, I mean, I've stood in places in Arizona when I lived out there. I've stood in places where I said, and I say it on camera and use it in one of our spots here, that all of this around me here looks like Mars with cactus on it. That's what it looks like. Okay, so 30 million light years away, and maybe they're hanging out here. Have you, in any of your research, is there anything that has focused you on a particular constellation? Not where you've nailed it down, but something that about it that says that's probably where this is.
Well, not implant wise, but you know, I've been hanging around this subject now like an old clothespin for quite a few years. And when you look at the ancient artifacts, sacred sites that are on the Earth, there isn't one single one of them which is not aligned with some heavenly constellation going back to Giza and the pyramids aligned with Orion. You take even Easter Island, the Nazca Lines, Stonehenge, it just goes on and on and on. They're all aligned with some kind of heavenly bodies. You know, and where did we get our primitive ancient religions from? From obviously objects that were above, objects in the sky. All of Zionism, for example, no matter what kind of a Zionist you are, whether you're Muslim or Jewish or whatever, all that type of theology is really the worship of Saturn and Saturn's rings. They were all Saturnists. So almost all the theological aspect of the development of mankind up until today is based on constellations or heavenly bodies.
Well, I certainly, I mean, you can see especially clearly, like with the Roman pantheon of gods and then the names of the planets, you know, the Roman pantheon of gods matches the names of the planets. And the thing, the here's what's hard in 2012 when we think about that aspect of it. We're sitting here in 2012 with a 2012 mindset and looking back at writings that we say are religious writings, and some of them quite obviously are. And there's no way that we cannot interpret those with a 2012 mindset. We can't get rid of it entirely. That mindset is a filter that we're having to look through. And there's no way to get rid of it entirely to see it the way they saw it. And what I wonder is it possible that what we have is some extraterrestrials who made it to Earth and had advanced technology and advanced abilities and obviously advanced knowledge and skill, and the people here on Earth said those are gods, but they were real people? And then perhaps the planets out there were named in honor of these real people. Because you see, what happens these days is they say that, you know, they named Mars Mars and then worshipped it as a god. And then they anthropomorphized it. But maybe it's the other way around. Maybe there were real people with those names and people here on Earth named planets and stars after them. What do you think?
Well, you know, that's a very interesting possibility, and I'm going to ask my friend Jordan Maxwell what his opinion is of that, because he's been studying this now for about 60 years, so really anxious to see what he says. That's very interesting. I never thought of that. I know that the early Catholicism, of course, was a pagan religion, but I know that they had a highly developed different astrology that was, you know, stricken from the religion when they switched over to Christianity. But there is a definite relationship to gods, to the planets, and to what people believed.
Yeah, and I find it difficult to think that people who could master the high mathematics and astronomy, which they obviously mastered to build these great cities and monuments, I find it very difficult to think that they were so naive as to think that thing up there they call Mars was a god. I think they named it after somebody. All right, we have to step away for break. We'll be back.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. For those of you joining us just now in this second hour, welcome aboard. I'm glad you're here. My sincere sympathy to you, though, for whatever it is that kept you away from us during that first hour. And here's my best hopes, wishes, prayers, and energies. Hoping you never, ever have to miss a first hour again. All right, we're talking this evening with Dr. Roger Lear, and we're going to open up the telephone lines now. The telephone number is 623-444-5889, 623-444-5889. If you're in Canada or the USA, please use that telephone number. If you're outside of Canada or the USA, it will work. However, we know it can be expensive to make international long-distance calls. So just go to my website, scroll down, and you'll see the picture about tonight's show. Right above that picture, you'll see a link that says Flash Message. You can send me your questions or comments that way, and I'll read them on the air, provided they pertain to tonight's show, and we will discuss them. To the telephone, let me just make sure that Dr. Lear made the trip with us because we switched phone lines on him. Dr. Lear, are you with me?
I am indeed.
All right. Let's go to the telephone lines. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yeah, hi, Kevin. This is Ryan in Washington here.
Hello, Ryan.
Yeah, Roger, I know that you've been going through a lot, so I understand that, but I've been trying to get in touch with you. I sent you an email one time, and you wanted to know more about me. If you remember that email that you got sent to you, that was me. Basically, I've been documenting and trying to do a little research or do something with the Cumberges UFO case that you saw or at least were one of the witnesses. And I know some other people in the UFO field who are interested too in trying to nail down the pieces of what happened there. And I was just wondering, could I send you an email later on and you can decide, maybe, and I'll wait till you're fully recovered before I call you, but I would just like to talk to you for maybe 10 minutes or so.
Yeah, sure. Just out of curiosity, which UFO case was this?
The Cumberges Turkey UFO case.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah. I found out some pretty interesting things about it so far. One of them is that there's a couple documents that are actually available from the astronomy department over there that are that come from them, and I've actually talked to one of the witnesses, the primary witness there guy. He's got a new camera, and he's still out there filming every night on his deck. But what's interesting about that case, Roger, is the beings in that. It appears that the beings in that have either evolved out of or they no longer have a slit for a mouth and a two notches for a nose. It seems to be that there's a sort of a ridge that goes from the top of the head down to the bottom of the chin. Like, you know, maybe they figured out, well, they don't use their nose or mouth anyway, so why even have...
Done by the Chilean videographer, analyst?
Yeah, he has high resolution images, but there just hasn't been anybody really doing anything with it. And I know that you've been sick, and so I'm just talking to a few other UFO researchers
to
trying
to astronomical report.
Yeah, there's a couple documents that are available for that. And so, anyways, there's a lot more to it, but. Kevin, you know what's really interesting about that whole case?
When you send me your email, just indicate the Cumberges case.
Okay, I'll tell you that I called you on Kevin Smith's show. And maybe I could just talk to you for
Ryan, minute, you're talking all up on top of him.
Do you know how close that is to Bulgaria?
Okay, Ryan, you're talking all over on top of Dr.
Okay,
Lear.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, Dr. Lear, go ahead and say that again for him.
Sorry about that.
Oh, I said when you email me... make sure you indicate dash Cumberges case, and that way I'll answer it right away.
Okay. Maybe I could just ask you one question, then I'll let the next caller come in. Were there any other English-speaking or any other American researchers that were there, too, that were witnesses as well?
they weren't researchers, but there was people from the United States that was there. And at one time we had someone from the, I won't say what branch, but someone from the U.S. military was also there.
Okay, there you go. All right, Ryan, thank you so much for the call. Interesting stuff. 623-444-5889. 623-444-5889. That would be the number for you to call if you have a question or a comment for Dr. Lear. This would be a great opportunity for you to talk with him. He's sort of been out of circulation here for a while. And we're fortunate that he's able to be with us this evening. 623-444-5889. This case, for those who are new to the show and perhaps new to the genre, the case that Ryan is talking about is a case of, it's a UFO sighting, several sightings, as a matter of fact, that Dr. Lear was in Turkey, present when it was filmed. He was there with the guy who was filming it. And it is absolutely amazing because you can see the craft quite clearly. You can see through some, I guess, windows. And you can see the beings, the creatures, the people inside this craft. And they don't look like us. The film, the video has been verified to be genuine. And so that's the case Ryan is talking about. All right, to the telephone caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Kevin, this is Brent from Wyoming.
Hello, Brent.
Dr. Lear, I'm going to shift gears kind of radically on you for a minute. One of my interests is 3D printing. And the thing that bugs me about these chips, these implants, is they're so small, the manufacturing process would be unimaginable by today's standards.
They
now have metal printers that will print in titanium. I think one's brass, and I don't know if one's copper or silver or whatever. But there is one that'll give you up to 107 materials. Now, what I'm wondering is, could our current black budget level of 3D printing be enough to mimic this kind of chip? And that's just what calling for speculation on your part.
First of all, I saw a demonstration of early 3D printing, with the outcome of materials that were non-metal. Which was very impressive. I didn't know that they had gone that far. But you're hitting on something which is basic to advanced manufacturing processes. I don't know of one single eyewitness, and I've been studying this subject as I mentioned before, like an old clothespin hanging around for a long time. I don't know one witness that has gotten close to a UFO, either with a pair of binoculars or without visually, that ever indicated a seam, a nut, or a bolt. So I would assume that when we talk manufacturing processes like 3D printing, they have something that's so far advanced that would probably make 3D printing look...
I don't know what happened, but we just about lost your audio. But you were saying, Dr. Lear, you don't know of any 3D printing that could handle this. Is that right?
Basically, I'll say what I did over again. In my years of experience in looking at the UFO subject, I've never interviewed or read an eyewitness that was a close-up encounter with an object, whether it was in Rendlesham Forest or somewhere else, that ever described a nut, a bolt, or a seam on any of these aircraft. boy, if you want to call them vehicles or whatever you want to call them. So I would assume that their definition of manufacturing is highly advanced over what we have here. So if we can now use 3D molding, 3D transmission and printing to use metal, I think that's a tremendous advance or step in technology. But I think it's, in comparison to what they're using, is probably Stone Age.
Okay. And Brent, you have another question or comment?
No, that's it. That's, okay, thanks. Goodbye.
All right, thanks. 623-444-5889. And we also have to say this, Dr. Weir. Let's assume that we do have the capability to do the 3D printing to turn these chips out. Let's assume we do. These chips that you have examined and that Bob Kuntz has tested have materials that are not from Earth.
That's correct.
So we would have to have someone bringing us those materials, or we would have to, from 30 million light years away, or we would have to have the capability to go there ourselves and come back with that material one way or the other. If it's coming from 30 million light years away, even if it's 3D printing, the raw material from which the 3D printing is done is not, would not be from Earth.
Yeah, unless there is a secret process in which you can transmute metals, which they say was done in ancient times, where you can move isotopes around so that they're non-terrestrial. I don't know. We're just, you know, almost getting in a field of, when you talk about black budget advanced technology, you're almost getting in a fairyland, because everything is so hidden. You know, I remember years and years and years ago when Lockheed Skunk Works was combining neurological material with metal so they could do in-flight wing warping. You know, everybody thought that was miraculous. Now it's done all the time. Now we talk to black budget people to say we have small anti-grav generators in vehicles that require a long takeoff roll, such as the B-1 bomber, which is ancient technology. So it gets so confusing that. But let's. What I was going to mention before was one of the things that Brent's not taking into consideration is not just the object itself, but the ability to get the human to, you know, not only get them, but to put that object in the body with no scar and no biological findings. Also, I don't know whether advanced technology that we have has the capability of turning non-organic material into organic material, but we do find that the ceramic biological-like covering that covers these metal objects is phase-grown from the object itself. So, you know, it just gets back to the question, how advanced are we? Could we do that in 100 years if it's 100 years advanced? I don't know.
Yeah.
But it's a whole process. I mean, you can't, as far as I know, we don't have, we can see through walls. I mean, we know that. Police have that. Military has that kind of those devices. But we can't walk through a wall, as far as I know. But yet they can.
And maybe
levitate,
maybe
they can come through a wall.
Maybe we can.
Object. I've even had people tell me that when they were on a craft, the craft actually threw a solid material object. So, you know,
yeah.
I don't know.
All right, let's go back to the telephone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin. This is Lasha, and I'm calling from Vancouver.
Hello, Lasha.
How are you?
Good. Go ahead.
I have a question. I'm very interested in how these implants get into people, because I have one. And I remember it being given to me in a dream. And the reason it strikes me so much tonight is the picture that Kevin has on his webpage. It was exactly that shape, that weird triangle shape. And I remember having it in a dream, as if I was dreaming that I hit my elbow on something. But I knew immediately, because I've done a lot of dream work, that that was like a screen memory, and I had this flash of two people standing there. And the next day I had this big, well, not big, little triangle on my elbow, and I went to my doctor, and she said, it looks like a laceration, but there's no bruising. And it healed very quickly. Do other people have that kind of experience?
Did they take an x-ray?
Pardon me?
Did they take an x-ray?
No, she just looked at it and said, it looks like a laceration of some kind. And my arm, it's very funny that you were just talking about things being invisible, because I know this is going to sound crazy, but I've had experiences like that with my arm. At one point, my hand passed through a park bench. It scared the hell out of me. But, and I'm very interested too in what you say about that it's connected with metal and the nerves, because that was my intuitive feeling, is that it was somehow doing something, it was connected with a nerve tissue in my arm or whatever. I'm not a doctor, I don't know. But I'm just wondering if other people who have had them have had similar dream experiences when they got them, or what do they say they come from? Like, where do they say they got these?
In short, the answer to that is yes. Some do, some don't. Now, there are certain marks that people find on the body that are abductees. And
right.
One of them, one of the common ones, is a triangle.
Really?
I do have some of them, I believe, up on the website. Some are arrangements of dots in various patterns. You may find dot in the shape of a cube, or dot in the shape of a dot in the shape of a rectangle, and so on. The other is bruising for no particular reason. Others
right.
appear to be scratches, and of course the most classic of them all is the classical scoop mark, where it looks like a tiny little teaspoon has gone in and scooped part of your skin out.
To me, this felt almost like it was a puncture tool that went in and put something,
that's,
do you know? It had
quite,
that feeling to
quite,
it.
Quite common, but whether there's an object underneath, you can only tell by taking an x-ray or a CAT scan, not an MRI. I have to emphasize that. Don't go waste your money with an MRI. Either a plain, simple x-ray or a CAT scan. And if it shows something, it's there. And
then
if it doesn't
should get
show
one, then.
Anything, a last resort is you might want to do an MRI.
Well, I don't know if I want to know what it is.
Well, that's the next thing. Yes, you should search your soul. And
right.
really want to know if you're at peace now. You may not want to know anymore. Now, Whitley Strieber still has the one in his ear. He knows that it's there. He knows that it's moved, that it moves. There was an attempt to remove it, not by me, but by Dr. John Lerma. And when it moved out of the way, the doctor about fainted and put in a couple of sutures and closed it up because he was frightened to death. Whitley asked me, if you go remove it, can you guarantee I won't die? No. How could I ever make such a guarantee? So he most probably will have his in forever.
Lasha, I have a question for you.
Yes, I can hardly hear you, Kevin.
I want to hear your story about your hand passing through the park bench.
I didn't hear you, Kevin. You're very faint.
Can't get any louder.
Can you tell us about your experience where your hand passed through a park bench?
Well, it was the strangest thing. I was doing my work, and then sometimes I take a break, and I go out and sit on a park bench. And sometimes I just sit and listen to nature and that kind of stuff. And sometimes I sort of quietly meditate. And I was quietly meditating for a few minutes. And I got up to walk away, and I put my hand on the back of the bench, and it went right through the wood. I don't know why it did.
Did it hurt? Did you have any pain or tingling?
No, I had no pain. it felt like I was brushing past something, but I was brushing through something. There was a little bit of a tingle in my hand, my arm. And you know, it scared the hell out of me. I couldn't look at my hand right away. Like, it was, you know, I mean, you know, you don't expect something like that. I mean, I don't know. It was the same arm where the elbow, where I had the puncture thing in the elbow. It was the same hand.
Did you, by any chance, notice your surroundings? You indicated this was a park bench. Indicating it's a park bench, it would indicate to me that this happened in a park.
No, it was a courtyard of a condo complex.
Courtyard of a condo. Okay, so it was open to the air.
Yes.
And you have things like birds flying around, and airplanes flying overhead, and
yeah, we're right next to an airport, actually. Yeah.
Okay, during the time your hand passed through the bench, did you notice anything unusual about the sound, if you can remember?
Do you know, that's very interesting that you asked that. Sound, it was really, really, really quiet. And I remember, it reminded me of a time when I was a child, I saw a UFO up close and personal. And it was so quiet, it was otherworldly. Like, it was vacuum quiet. It was, you know, it kind of reminded me a little bit of that, but just for a split second.
I asked that question, of course, for a specific reason, because there could have been a craft in the area that was doing something, observing you, or when they do that, they project a magnetic field. And that magnetic field might have been around you, and that what accidentally might have let you put your hand through the bench. But there are many cases in which, either with natural recall or with the help of hypnotherapy, people will describe a quietness that's beyond a normal quiet. Birds will be totally silent. There won't be any sounds of the forest. You could be running through a forest and you won't hear your own footfall. So silence, and that just kind of clicked in my mind. There might have been an unseen craft that had you in a field.
Right, Lasha. Thank you so much for the call. Very, very interesting, intriguing, as a matter of fact. 623-444-5889. 623-444-5889. That would be the number for you to call. Dr. Lear, we have to step away for a break. But when we come back, I want to come back to this hand going through the park bench. I've got a question for you about that. And we'll get to that
okay,
on the other
side.
Yeah, we'll get to that on the other side of this upcoming break. Ladies and gentlemen, we're talking with Dr. Roger Lear, the guy you've seen on television, responsible for taking alien implants out of people. All right, we'll be back right after this.
Listening to the Kevin Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and my guest this evening, Dr. Roger Lear. Okay, now when we went away for break, Dr. Lear, I said, I have a question about that hand going through the park bench, because when she started telling about this, you started asking questions that sound like informed questions. So my question to you is, does that indicate that this is not that rare?
Well, an isolated case of someone putting a hand through a bench is rare. However, the silence that she describes and the abduction scenario of passing through a wall or a window or a solid object is not rare. And the two kind of go along together.
So then, is it possible that there was an abduction beginning, but for some reason it didn't complete?
Well, you've just hit on something. Abductions, you know, without a good regressive hypnotist, you know, looking into the case, she could have been abducted. And although they may be millions of years older than us, they're not without flaw.
Mm-hmm.
So they might have taken her, put her back on the park bench, and she may think she passed her hand through the bench, but unfortunately, she may be telling the story backwards. She may have taken her hand out of the bench because they, the feel that they used to replace her, you know, makes the solid molecular matter evidently dematerialized or a change phase in relationship to time. So she could have been, she could have underwent an abduction event.
You mentioned that a lot of these implants, there's no sign on the surface of the body, on the skin, of an entry wound.
That's correct. There's no portal of entry visible whatsoever.
All right, so how many years have you been doing this?
Oh, let's see. I did the first case, I believe, in 1995.
All right. Over all these years, have you come to, I know it's speculative, but have you come to some opinion about how these implants get into people without leaving a scar?
I don't spend too much time on how they get into people because I accept the fact that they have advanced technology. If they're able to disassociate by phase matter, and it's a wall or a window or other solid object that perhaps a smaller instrument of such would dephase the molecular structure of the human body, they would merely place the object inside, manipulate the surrounding soft tissues that they needed, blood supply and nerve supply to the object, and then just dephase everything, and you know, that's it. It's done. This is happening, Kevin, you know, all over the world. And, you know, if you talk about a few million people in the United States, that's nothing. Based on a world basis, that means millions and millions and millions of people have been abducted. So if you, you know, by simple mathematical mechanics, if you were going to genetically, for example, re-manipulate the human race, which according again to ancient times looks like it's been done before, if you're going to do that, you're going to have, you know, so much personnel and so many craft, and you can't dilly-dally around. You got to do something in a hurry. So it looks like, since most of these things are found in fairly superficial areas and next to the bone, and we believe the bone now can be used as an antenna, as an actual conductor, to help you know, receive the most probably biological information or genetic information they're looking for in reference to something that they've done genetically. And since most abductions involve the taking of ova and sperm, I guarantee you they're not taking that stuff to make omelets. There's something genetic going on with the human race, and from what I see of the young people and the changes going on in the world, it's due to the young people. You look at the whole Middle Eastern situation, That's all people less than 35 years of age. They're not stupid. They know they can get tortured and killed and everything else. But they are virtually changing the world. And if you look at kids today, I was in the...
Okay, let me say to our caller, hang on, let me say to the caller, hang on, we'll get to you here in just a second. Dr. Lear, go ahead.
Yeah, I was in a museum in Philadelphia, Science Natural History Museum, and they had a display of mechanical wooden machines that were designed by Leonardo da Vinci, and the museum built them, and they were functional. And then in an adjoining room, they had pedestals with the top covered with the computers. And the screens were like you see on CSI or Hawaii 5-0, where they take their hand and they throw them, into the air, and it sticks vertically, magically in the air. Well, here were kids that were 5, 6, 7 years old, and their parents were probably in their 20s or so. And these kids are flipping these screens and building these objects that Leonardo da Vinci had designed, with the computer. And the parents are standing there, with their mouth hanging open, without the slightest bit of understanding what the heck the kids are doing.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. Okay, caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Kevin, this is Steve from Georgia.
Hello, Steve.
Dr. Lear, I'd like to offer a possible means of putting these implants into people without leaving a scar. You know, we are capable of a lot of nanotechnology ourselves. We use that in, for instance, in the chemtrail phenomenon. You know, there are particles of aluminum, barium, strontium, etc., in those chemtrails that are so tiny, so microscopic that they're absorbed into soil, they're absorbed into the parts of plants that are supposed to transmit and receive pollen, and they're absorbed into the human through our skin, through our mucous membranes, and using fluoride that's in our water supply that is also in our system because we consume it, fluoride becomes a carrier that moves this stuff readily across the blood-brain barrier into the brain. And where chemtrails are particularly heavily sprayed, you find increased levels of Alzheimer's, that the aluminum and other substances leave. You won't find the actual particles of the metals, but what you find is the result of the accumulation of these metals. Your organic farmers aren't growing crops as well as they used to because of the nanoparticles clogging the pollen delivery systems. Soil is being changed. The pH of the soil is changed. Monsanto has had to develop aluminum resistant corn seeds and so on in order for corn to replenish itself and to actually grow the corn. And something that you mentioned, Dr. Lear, is that these particles, you mentioned that the implants, when they're disassembled, when they're shaken apart, if they're in a little tube, they tend to reassemble themselves. You know, they have that artificial intelligence seemingly built into them where they can reassemble themselves. Well, I would offer the possibility that if these things are distributed in the air and they're absorbed through the skin without leaving a mark, that if it's the right particles with the right programming, that once they're in the skin of a human being, they found a host, that they can assemble themselves into the desired implant. And then once that implant is in place, it would not only maybe transmit, but it would actually also serve as a receiver for some kind of transmission, that they want the person to receive. And it could engineer a person's entire perception, and it could be used as almost a remote control receiver device inside a person where you could direct a person to do almost anything. You know, I'm just throwing that out there. What do you think about that, Dr. Lear?
Okay, well, I have two quick comments for you. I find your information very interesting. Number two, have you seen a film called Genetic Roulette?
I have not.
I suggest you go on the internet and purchase one for $15. That's my first comment. Second comment is that do you realize how large a sonometer is?
Oh, sure.
Okay, well, one of the objects we removed was a sonometer in each direction. That would be very hard to particleize and then reassemble and assemble also a blood and nerve supply to it through a specialized nerve system called proprioceptors. So I don't think that what you're suggesting is a possibility of how they get into. The other things you're suggesting are happening. There's no question as to whether things are going on. But do get that film, Genetic Roulette, and you will find a lot of things that you just got through talking about in extreme, extreme detail.
All right, I'll do it. Thank you, Dr. Lear, and thank you, Kevin, for taking my call.
Thank you for calling.
Yeah, all right, Steve, thank you for the call. 623-444-5889. 623-444-5889, and we're talking this evening with Dr. Roger Lear. If you are outside of the USA or you're outside of Canada, you may also, you can use the number, but you may also use the Flash message feature. Caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Kevin, this is Jerome from Pennsylvania.
Hello, Jerome.
Hi, Dr. Lear.
Hi there.
I'd like your response to Steve's ideas as far as why you don't think they're implanted that way, and also the fact that you don't care how they're implanted, the fact that they are there is enough for you. But my question is, I always thought that the elements we see on Earth, that these elements would be throughout the universe. And what I'm getting at is, you mentioned about copper and being some 30 light years away. I thought copper is copper no matter where it is.
No, sir. You're wrong. Every element in the universe is composed of the same makeup, let's say. It has a nucleus, and that nucleus contains subatomic particles, such as neutrons, which are neutrally charged. There are a certain number of positive particles, which are in the nucleus, and outside, the simplest of all elements, there's a spin of an electron, which is a negatively charged particle. Now,
all right, we have to step away for break. Both of you hang on, and we'll be back with that explanation right after this. Don't go away. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and we are on final approach. That means we only have a few minutes left. On the telephone with us is Jerome from Pennsylvania. Are you still with me, Jerome?
Yes, I am, Kevin.
And Dr. Roger Lear, are you still with me?
Yes, sir.
All right. Now, you had just got started explaining this question, and it's a reasonable question. I thought copper was copper anywhere you find it in the universe, and you were explaining why it's different.
Okay, well, it's not just the copper, of course. It's every element.
Yeah.
When we mine, let me first say this, when we mine elements on the Earth, the natural, what are called a natural abundance ratio of isotopes is relatively the same within 0.2%, or maybe up to 2%. If we find that the isotopic ratios are different than that, we know they're not earthly. But anyway, I was just trying to explain to you as simple as possible what an isotope is. As I said, we have an atom with a nucleus, and the nucleus are the neutrons, which are the neutral particles, and we have the protons, which are the positive particles. The charges are in balance with an electron, which is a negatively charged particle, which is spinning around. Now, if you take in consideration the mass of the nucleus, or you can consider it as weight, and the number of protons and neutrons that are on the nucleus, they vary. And this number produces what is called an isotope. Now, everybody knows, I think, that we like U-235, which is uranium-235, to make bombs out of, because it's very radioactive. And the reason is that that is one of the isotopes of uranium. So just because you mine uranium doesn't mean that you're going to get 100% U-235. U-235 has to be separated. So if we look at iron or copper or some of the elements, for example, that come from the moon or from meteorites, we know the origin of the meteorite within our solar system or universe, we can say, yes, this meteorite came from so-and-so, or this rock came from Mars, such as the meteorite that landed at the North Pole, where they isolated bacterial hydrocarbon life. So that's how they know where it came from, because the isotopes are different. So anywhere, as I said, you mine copper on Earth, it's going to be within a 2% range. If you mine copper and you look at the isotopic ratios and they are way off from that, then we can say they are non-terrestrial isotopes. And I tried to answer a kind of a complex question in a simple way, but I hope it gives you a clue to the understanding of what we're talking about.
Yes, it does, and thank you for explaining it with the uranium isotope. It kind of filled it in to me. I also wish you Godspeed in your healing process, and And Kevin, one last thing: if maybe you could do a real people segment with that Lasha, that sounds like that'd be very interesting.
A real people segment with who?
Lasha, the previous caller.
You know what? If you go over to our archives, you'll find the show we did with her not too long ago.
Boy, I must have missed that, but I will do that.
All right, she's in there.
Thank you, Kevin.
All right. Okay, we have time for one more call if it comes in right now, but if you let a couple of minutes go by, it's going to be too late for us to take the call. So the isotopic ratio really sort of is the home address of the element, right?
That's correct. Now, what we don't know, and of course there's a lot of things that we don't know as far as academic science knows, and I'm not talking about black budget science, but we don't know, for example, that copper or iron or selenium that comes from Mars happens to be the same as what comes from the moon or from some other solid object in space. We don't know enough about that yet. But, you know, we do have this new robotic apparatus on Mars that is shooting a laser into a rock, and it's going to bust things down, and it'll be broadcasting back as to what kind of isotopes they're finding, because they use rather different methods called spectrometry. They look at the colors of the various elements after they've been blasted with a laser, so they can get some isotopic ratios from that. We can find out some more about the soil and rock constituents of Mars.
Well, I think this new rover is aptly named. It's called Curiosity, and I think it's a very apt name for this rover, because Number one, they say it's because, you know, we have this great curiosity about the possible building blocks of life on Mars. But also, it's very, very curious to me that they would go looking for the building blocks of life when they already ran an experiment. And you know, curiosity. And they ran an experiment in 1971 looking for signs of biological processes, which found signs of biological processes. And then they said, they announced it, and then they backed up and punted and said, no, wait a minute, we think it was a mistake. We're going to run a different experiment. So they ran one not designed to find biological processes, and voila, it did not find biological processes. So then they said, you see, there are none. So they already know there is.
Yeah, they did a switcheroo after that, too.
Yeah.
And because they were attacked so vehemently by the scientific community, they did a 180 and said, yes, that's we probably did isolated carbon life form in that meteorite. But, you know, when you look at the polar regions of Mars and you look at the changes because of the seasons, and then the close-up views, hey, there's something growing there. And when something grows, man, to me, that's life.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, I think they have already found life on Mars. They know there's life on Mars. And we're not talking about upright, walking around, intelligent life, although that may be there, too. But there's life on Mars. They found it. They know that with the Levin experiment. On the Viking lander in 1971, they've known since then there's biology happening on Mars. And
they also know by even the superficial knowledge that they're passing out to the public by looking at the terrain. They knew at one time that Mars was probably covered with large oceans because of what they see in the current topography.
Yeah.
Where'd that water go? I mean, you know, if there was a calamity, which we think that did happen with Mars, and it got knocked off its orbit, lost its atmosphere, and so on, maybe, you know, there's still gravity there. There's probably more gravity than what they're telling us, as there is barometric pressure. Now, we had some
Got less than a minute.
And what they're saying is an absolute lie, because they measure the amount of material that's blown around the planet when they have their severe dust storms, and you have to have a certain barometric pressure in order for the atmosphere to carry that amount of material.
That's true. And you know, they also say that the atmosphere is so thin that there's no possibility that it can form liquid water. So if there's no possibility of handling the formation of liquid water, how is it that it also has the ability to pick up dust and move dust, which is a lot heavier than oxygen and hydrogen necessary to form water? All right, we are out of time. Dr. Lear, if you will, just stay with me on the line for a minute as I bring this in for a landing. And I want to chat with you for just a moment after we go off the air. There you have it, ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Roger Lear. Get over to alienscapel.com, alienscapel.com, and make a donation for the support of one of the premier researchers in our genre. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do, too. You can call me whatever you'd like to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.